adjust your dial. This is not a test. We control the airwaves. This is The Last Horror Cast.
Maybe even the same weekend I watched Basket Case for the first time.
Basket Case I love.
See, I remember both of them kind of meshing together, but also fitting together very well. Like, they kind of complement each other in a lot of the same ways. And that's not to say that the quality is the same, but just in terms of
that weird little monkey person that kills people on your behalf. One's his, like, Siamese brother, and one's an actual monkey.
Belial?
Yeah.
Belial, the Siamese basket twin.
Did you ever watch any of the Basket Case sequels?
No. In fact, I was not even aware that there were any until about a year ago.
That's your best off not being aware. It goes so off the rails after the first one. I think they did that weird 80s thing where they tried to become comedies, but it's just like, no.
Yeah, the first one was pretty ridiculous in its own right, but still pretty fun.
Yeah, and I love those old movies from the 80s where New York was just a friggin' cesspool of disgust.
I love that. Yeah. All right, well, should we get down to business this week? I guess we can call this 30.5 or 31?
29.5, 30. I don't know. I was going to let you make that call.
We'll just make it the mannequin episode, mannequin bonus feature.
All right.
So kind of missed a couple weeks there. We were gone... Well, kind of just had some technical problems and some illnesses and various life crap 2 weeks ago, and then I was on vacation, so you and Tony decided to fill in and put out episode 30 for us. That seemed to be pretty well received, so thanks for doing that one.
People were excited to hear Tony back on the air. It's interesting how happy people were to not hear me talk for an hour.
I was glad that so far we haven't gotten any feedback that was, oh, thank God that Scott guy's gone. Like, now the show is actually good. But of course, we also have not had any feedback of people saying, like, oh, man, like, when's Scott coming back? So I'm kind of just hanging out there in limbo. I'm assuming that I maybe have a couple of the fan, like a small percentage maybe is, you know, my fan base. But I don't know. That might be delusional.
You're in charge of the editing. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks.
I'm an administrator on the Facebook page. I can just kick off the people that don't like me.
Yeah. Blatant abuse of power.
Well, what's the point of having power if you can't abuse it?
Fair enough.
So I think that was a pretty well-received episode. I am, you know, no offense to Anthony, but I'm thrilled that I did not have to watch those two films. And I mean, that's saying a lot because I'm obviously not the best at picking movies, but I don't think I would have picked either of those. So would you walk away recommending either of them to me?
If you're going to watch one, I would watch Phantom of the Paradise. As far as Captain Invincible, I mean, I would look up individual clips of it on YouTube. They're individually funny, but I think I said last week it feels like one really long SNL skit. You know, if SNL did an entire night dedicated to that type of movie, that's what they would do, and that's sort of how it came across to me.
Some of your descriptions of, like, Christopher Lee singing and having, like, I don't know, I might have to YouTube at least that kind of stuff, because that kind of sounds amazing.
Yeah, Christopher Lee singing a song about different drinks. I mean, basically every lyric of the song is the name of a drink put into order to try to convince Captain Invincible to drink them, because that's his weakness, which I can respect. But yeah, I mean, it's hilarious. It's just, you're an hour and 10 minutes into the movie when that happens, and you've just seen the same kind of joke. So again, individually, I think most of the scenes worked.
Time got away from me because I was on vacation, but I really wanted to get onto Facebook and start like a betting pool, like an over-under onto how many minutes into the episode before Christopher Lee would show up. And this was before I knew that the movie actually had Christopher Lee in it, so... As I'm sitting in the car on the drive home from vacation listening to the kind of raw audio that you had sent me, and I'm just like, oh, I wasn't kidding. He is there.
Yep.
So it worked out very well. It was a good episode, so I was was glad to hear it. Glad we got something up. A little bit of work to kind of edit it all together, but I think it turned out listenable at least.
I haven't listened to it yet, so I'll let you know maybe next time we record.
Yeah, would you send me that in like 4 different files, and feedback was in 2, and the main body was in 2, and I feel like there was at least one, because like I listened to it and didn't quite pay attention to when I was supposed to, or all the little things I was supposed to cut out, so I think at least one thing Anthony said, like whispering into the mic, like, hey Scott, this should be cut out, like, I think I missed at least one, so if it's a little Easter egg in there for...
He seemed to enjoy doing that. He liked the idea that he was creating work for you. Not sure why.
Well, so the episode before that one was going to be our mannequin episode, and we kind of decided that we didn't want to just leave that hanging. We had watched both of those movies for that week and had some thoughts on them and wanted to actually talk, and knew that there were some listeners that went to the trouble to track them down. So we thought that we'd throw something out there. This is not going to be our full episode. You're still going to get a regular episode this week as well, but we thought let's do a little short something to cover off the mannequin theme horror.
Yeah.
So
especially since at least one of these films was specifically requested by a listener. So
right. We figured at least indulge a little bit. So, well, it's been, I'm going to admit it's going to be a little bit rusty here because it's now been 2 weeks since I've seen these. I've seen other things in between, and it's been a week sitting on the beach since then, so I'm going to do my best to synopsize some of these, and to be perfectly fair, these were some pretty fucked up plots to begin with, so
yeah.
I think I described both of these after watching them as like, this is some of the best representation of just pure insanity on film that you can get.
Okay. All right, well, why don't we get into exactly what was insane about the films then? Do you have one you'd rather start with?
Well, I got the Tourist Trap pulled up here on IMDb right now, so let's just go into that. It's less clicking around on the keyboard. So do you want to try to synopsize this one here, and I can take a shot at the next one?
Sure. So Tourist Trap, I mean, it's essentially a slasher, so we already know the plot. Group of kids stumble across this old tourist trap, which has like, you know, a swimming hole out front, and it has a store and a little restaurant and a museum full of wax museums or wax figures, which are all the animatronic kind. So they move around and they kind of talk and stuff. And I mean, it's convoluted, but at the same time, very simple. One by one, for various reasons, they all wander from the main tourist trap area to the back house, where they're systematically kidnapped, killed, turned into mannequins, that sort of thing, which, I mean, it's the most predictable way this could possibly go. We finally, basically, it's not really clear to me why, but one of the girls is treated differently. She is able to escape, and she makes off. I mean, it's the most typical slasher plot ever. We'll get into, I think, the specifics in trying to discuss what we liked and didn't like, but I mean, it literally is like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but instead of Leatherface, there's mannequins.
Yeah, except you're glossing over kind of one of the most important things that separates this from pretty much anything I've ever seen, and that is, like, right away, one of the characters ends up in this little shack room, and we're going full on Charles Band Puppet Master thing, because everything's moving. Like, this isn't just we're in this crazy place where there's animatronics. Like, there are plates, there's shit flying around the room, like the mannequins and puppets are laughing at him. Like, I mean, right away you're looking at this going, at least I was watching this, like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah. That opening kill, I mean, he wanders into some room, and for whatever reason, everything in there is animatronic or whatever. And I mean, I don't know if they're strictly animatronic, if they're possessed. I mean, at the end of the movie, I still don't know. There is some stuff that happens that is clearly not just animatronics, including items being moved telekinetically at various points in the movie. I don't really know how to explain what happened. It's insane. I know that.
Yeah, you basically have, and this is the spoiler-free explanation, but you have a killer who is obsessed with mannequins and creating them, but he also happens to be a telekinetic and can move things with his mind and is batshit insane and also likes to dress up like female mannequins a la Leatherface. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's kind of all of those things in one. There is a story and it's coherent enough. It's just the level of insanity throughout it all. It's just like, wow, this guy is crazy.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you take it, okay, this guy's a bad guy, and either he runs this tourist trap and has gone nuts and kills people who come by, or he's telekinetic, or whatever. I mean, if you just remove him from the equation, everything else in the story mostly makes sense. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the whole plot of the film centers around what I think is him magically breaking down their vehicle when they get too close.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think it's ever explained that he has magic powers, but he's able to make their vehicle stop working when they get too close just by looking at it from the woods, I think.
The headlight explodes. I mean, yeah, it's...
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, so it's not just an engine problem. It's the headlight blows up. That doesn't happen no matter how badly your engine stops working. To my knowledge, anyway, I'm not really a car guy.
Maybe on the new halogens or LED headlights, maybe those are...
Yeah. Maybe back in the 70s, like, headlights exploded a lot. I don't know. But it's really weird because...
Sloppy.
Yeah, because all the kills are manual kills. It's him stabbing people, or some of them are, you know, items being stabbed, but we presume that he's set them up. Yet he does seem to have these magic powers when it's convenient. And it's very strange.
Yeah, it's controlled by him staring super intently at whatever he wants to manipulate. And... Man, he can look at that stuff with a ferocity.
Yeah. Well, and we get that early on when he just kind of hovers around the girls who are skinny dipping and stares at them with ferocity. And for somehow, two out of the three are creeped out by it. The third one thinks, oh, he's just a nice old man who likes to stare at naked girls while they swim. Which, I mean, we all would like to stare at that, but you don't be so obvious, right?
As in the 70s, I think you could get away with that a little bit more. And... I mean, let's.
Yes.
You also.
I mean, they were on his property.
And skinny dipping on his property too. I mean, that's. Yeah. I don't know. Like, that's kind of invitation in a way. Like, they know what they're doing, right?
Yeah. I'm just gonna walk away from that, but I'll talk back to talking about the movie because I don't want to end up in any kind of trouble.
That's probably safe.
We're gonna get some feminist groups protesting us. but. One of the problems I have with the movie, and this is a good time to bring it up because the skinny dipping scene is a prime example, is the movie doesn't really ever commit to being anything. And part of that is probably because I think it was a made-for-TV film.
Yes.
It is shot on a low budget. And so you get this weird thing where you've got these girls clearly skinny dipping. Now, why do you have a skinny dipping scene in a movie where you aren't allowed to show nudity because it's on TV? That's a weird thing to do. And I don't understand why they wouldn't rewrite the script when they realized that this is going to be made on a lower budget for a TV audience and say, okay, well, instead of skinny dipping, they'll do something else in those woods that are, you know? And I think the film suffers like that throughout. I think that's the problem with the killer is they never decide whether he's going to be a crazy guy that sets up his mannequins to kill people or whether he's going to be a magic man that can kill people with his mind. They never felt like they had to make those decisions. They never committed to anything.
Well, and some of the nudity aspect that you were talking about, I mean, this was 1979, but it's also listed as PG, and obviously before PG-13 and television, obviously you're not going to have an R-rated movie. But, yeah, so I think it was their way of still having a quote-unquote traditional horror film, but let's just take out all of the things that we can't quite go past that level, which is why, you know, the gore was definitely toned down and no nudity. And, you know, I guess kind of what you're saying about the whole, it didn't really commit to anything. I think that's true. And it definitely felt confused, but I think that a lot of it was just one of these. I mean, you got to also realize that this was before a lot of that formula that we know was established. So
I agree with that. Yeah.
Referring to this as a slasher, but I mean, this was 1979, so before we had a true slasher formula. So to that extent, like, it was kind of just, we're just going to throw crazy stuff out there, and there you go.
I promised the listeners last week that we'd have a whole separate discussion about 70s slashers that came out before the formula was established. So we'll save this conversation for then. But I still feel like this film just, you know, like I said, when you find out that you can't have nudity, take out the scene that's only there to have nudity. You know, just fudge that into something else, anything else. I mean, that guy could have just walked up to them while they were still standing by their Jeep and offered to help, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he was, there's no reason for, to have that happen. I don't, and maybe it's a time thing or whatever else, but I just, I feel like when films, you know, try to walk that line, they're rarely successful.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's just,
I feel like it's a trend that's been happening, like, with a lot of the movies I've been watching lately. Like, we saw, what was it? I guess a spoiler already for some of the ones that we're doing for this week's episode, but same kind of thing. Like, we're 80s slashers that are, like, right on the cusp. Like, you're expecting to see some nudity, and they're somewhere, and then it just, like, never quite goes there. And
yeah,
I watched a couple other 70s grindhouse movies the other day that I was expecting. I can't remember the titles now. They were kind of forgettable, but it was the same kind of thing. Like, at any minute, they're going to, you know, pop out a boob or something, and it just teased it but never quite went there. So, yeah, that's kind of been a running theme of a lot of my viewing recently.
And I'm not sure if it's maybe we're spoiled. I mean, living in the internet era where we have, you know, Netflix on our homes and stuff, we're not thinking in terms of this was the most salacious thing that you could get onto TV and people were going to tune in just to see that. Maybe that mm-hmm. was the case at the time. But watching it from today's perspective, it just feels like, you know, and I'm not saying you need the nudity. I'm saying either go for it or don't, you know. I happened to have rewatched Friday the 13th Part 4 the other day, and that's a movie that went for it. They're just, they are just loving the nudity in that film, and it's like, that's great. You know what? Have your fun with it, and okay, but don't have the scene where the girl lifts up her shirt and then cut away just before you see anything. That's to me, that's just poor filmmaking.
Wasn't any Corey Feldman nudity in that one, was there?
No, not in that one.
Okay. It's been a while since I've seen it. I was hoping that that's not what you were going for there.
No, no, no. There was Corey Feldman as a 12-year-old boy peeping in on some girls while they were taking their clothes off. So,
as you do.
But like it's the same thing you were saying, right? They were asking for it basically by changing in front of their windows.
Right. I mean, if you're gonna have a keyhole in your door, like, come on.
It's nobody else's fault, right?
Okay, so what else? What are some of the other plot points that we can get into here? We talked about the crazy stuff flying all over the room in the very first scene. Like, that was really kind of what set the stage for me. And I think that that's kind of a telling scene when you sit down and watch that. Like, you know, it's either I'm into this or I'm not. Like, you kind of should pretty much know whether you should shut it off at that point. And I really liked it. I mean, I love the 70s stuff anyway, and I just thought that kind of set it up for and also at that point the credits are flying, and I saw that this was I believe Charles Band produced film, and
yeah,
made me think like, okay, so that's what we're getting into. I'm on board.
Yeah, and definitely a lot of the kill scenes were quite fun when you had various mannequins that were set up so that they, you know, shoot at the tourists, and then he switched out the bullets so every now and again they were firing real ones mm-hmm. and stuff like that. I thought that was really fun. You know, a lot of the kills were fun to watch in this film. There was definitely some moments where, like when the guy is running around the house and he's got this like fake mask on, it's like to look like a girl mannequin, and it looks so ridiculous that you can't help but enjoy it.
Yeah, it was very similar to what I think of as Leatherface from the original Texas Chainsaw, where it's close enough to a real face to make you obviously recognize it, but so distorted that it's just kind of something out of a nightmare. Yeah. And
this film could almost be described as a parody of Texas Chainsaw Massacre
in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I really liked about this is, despite all of the obvious comedy and just kind of goofiness throughout, there really was some truly creepy atmosphere too. And a little bit of it goes, or is, I guess you could give credit to the kind of like, gift shop itself, where the main character kind of has his little wax museum.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of a creepy setting, especially when you think of these kids who are stranded. They don't really know where they are, and there's just this one lone guy, you know, running the shop. And very similar to when we were talking about the Rob Zombie films a few weeks ago, you know, Captain Spaulding's curio shop, it's got that same kind of just uncomfortable oddity feel. But then throughout the course of the film, they start talking about how there's this house behind the property, and this main guy who runs the gift shop, it's his brother that lives in this house back behind there. And he warns him, like, don't go back there, my brother's crazy, like, it's not getting involved, don't leave the property, it's not safe. And of course, stupid teenagers are going to, and one by one, they end up wandering back there. But I thought the atmosphere of that house, and especially once they started getting in there, and there were just so many of these scenes with rooms just full of these mannequins, and it was super creepy, and I really dug that.
I agree with you there. Like, I think mannequins are sort of one of those things that are inherently creepy when you see them other than where you're supposed to see them. So if you're in a department store and you walk by, there's nothing really creepy about the mannequin wearing the newest, outfits. But when they're in somebody's home, they're just naturally a creepy thing to have, and you just don't want to see that.
And I think they use it to good effect. When you wake up in the morning and one's in bed with you, that's terrifying.
Yes, I assume. You save the rest of that story for your therapist. I agree with that. When they end up in the basement, too, so several of the characters are tied up in the basement at one, and that's genuinely creepy, the way they're sort of tied up, and our killer actually kind of leaves the keys just out of their reach as sort of a way to taunt them. And there's a new girl who's just down there when they get down there, which I thought was interesting. Like, you're like, you don't know where she really came from. And I like that.
Yeah, they never really explained her, did they?
No, she's just another passerby that's been kidnapped, and Lord knows how long she's been tied up in that basement.
Yeah, that is kind of a cool touch. So I don't want to get too spoilery with this. There is a little bit of a twist in terms of who the killer is and how it all ties together and all of that. I think it's pretty obvious when you start watching it what's going to happen, but just in case you don't see it coming, I would still recommend this and think it's a fun watch. So,
yeah. I don't necessarily recommend it.
Oh, really?
I still think if you're gonna watch it, let's keep it spoiler free. I don't have a problem with that. But my biggest complaint was probably the killer himself, because there are scenes where he's legitimately creepy, but then for some reason he becomes this weird. I don't know how to say it. Like, he's almost a comedic character.
It really is like a clown type, and part of it's the look of him too, like that. Big wig and the mask that he wears, the best way you can describe it, I mean, if you've seen the poster, that's him on the cover, but it's like if you took a wax or plaster, I guess it's a plaster mold of a face, but then kind of split the lip to where you could like unhinge the lower jaw, like, and then that's what he wears as a mask, so it allows him to still talk. You don't really see it move ever, so it just kind of has this weird line over his jaw. But yeah, the completely sunken in black eyes, but because he's a dude and fairly muscular, like, he looks huge and just awkward. But it's a female mask, so yeah, it just looks like something that I don't even know how to describe it. But yeah, Leatherface is what I keep going back to, because that seems to be, it's like if Leatherface were a clown, maybe.
Yeah, and I think that's intentional. The references to Leatherface and to Texas Chainsaw Massacre are clearly intentional in the plotting and everything, right down to the way they keep kind of going back to the house individually and getting caught one at a time. Like I say, for me, the problem is just when the killer has these people trapped and just goes into full clown mode for no reason, and it wastes all that atmosphere that they created with the mannequins upstairs and with the kind of creepy look, and I found it quite frustrating.
Yeah, see, I think it worked. I think it's not perfect. It was the kind of thing, like I said, from the beginning, you're either invested or you're not. And I guess I was kind of mentally prepared for the crazy clown comedy antics when I start seeing plates flying around and mannequins laughing hysterically at people. Like, I kind of already wasn't taking it too seriously, so maybe that's what kind of helped me. But
maybe
it's not the kind of thing that I would go out of your way to seek it out. But if you love slashers, and especially kind of like some of the 70s era stuff, or just offbeat things you probably haven't seen, then I think it's a interesting little piece of trivia to kind of tuck away in your brain. But
yeah,
I wouldn't go to too much effort, I suppose.
The only semi-spoiler thing I would point out, I think I've already basically said it, is that throughout the start of the film, you're not sure whether things are supernatural or whether this is just a crazy killer. And at the end of the film, you're still not sure. They don't explain that. So don't go into it thinking you're going to get that answer, because that would be very frustrating if you spent the whole movie for the explanation and it never comes.
Yeah, so. I kind of took it as him just being a telekinetic, but then there was other weird stuff with the deceased wife and other little things that just It just kind of made it weird, but pretty atmospheric. I thought it was pretty fun. Just don't set your hopes too high.
Yeah. And I mean, you tend to be a little more forgiving than me, so I think we're both kind of saw this film the same way. You're just nicer to people about it.
Yeah, that's. I think that's been proven. So I don't apologize for it either.
All right.
So any other talk on Tourist Trap you want to get out there before we move on?
No, I think that about covers it. I mean, like you say, it's been a couple of weeks since I saw it, but the big points that stick out to me have been made. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on to 1988, to Pin, which this was one I heard about years ago, and another one, kind of like Tourist Trap, it's pretty tough to track down. I mean, it's on Amazon, like you can buy it there, but it's not the easiest thing to find, which is why it's taken me this long to finally get to it. But I knew that it was somehow related to dummies or puppets or something, and it turns out that it's actually a anatomy doll. So like the kind of plastic skinless man you see in your doctor's office kind of thing. So figure close enough to mannequins that it counts.
Sure. We're not that strict with the rules around here. It counts.
Apparently not. But so I'll do my best here for a synopsis. You basically had a family of two kids, Leon and Ursula, brother and sister, and their father is a doctor who's very strict, but also, like, did I get this right that his office is, like, in the house? Like, it seemed like there were scenes where his office was there in the house. Other times I couldn't quite tell, but regardless, the kids are very involved with his practice, just kind of a small family practice thing. But the dad has this anatomy doll in his office that they call Pin, which you learn later is because when the daughter was really young, she called him Pinocchio, and that just got shortened to Pin. So Pin is this doll that the dad kind of uses as a teaching tool for discipline and that sort of thing, and teaching the kids life lessons. He's a kind of, I guess, a ventriloquist in a way, like he can kind of make Pin talk, and the kids love going in and talking to Pin. Never quite put together the fact that it only seems to work when their dad is around, but they think Pin is alive. And between the two, it's definitely Leon who kind of takes to Pin more so than Ursula. Like, I kind of get the impression that she doesn't really buy into it all that much, especially as they get older. But Leon buys in wholeheartedly that, yep, this is a real thing. Like, this doll is alive. And the movie kind of follows them past childhood into adulthood. There's an accident about a third of the way through the movie where the parents are in a car accident and they die. And so Leon and Ursula have inherited this huge estate and they're kind of just living on their own. Their aunt comes to live with them for a while. But the main driving force at this point is that Leon decides that he's going to bring Pin to the house and they're going to live with Pin. So we see that through a kind of a tragic event when he was a kid and seeing something he shouldn't have, Leon's crazy as hell and believes that Pin is real even into adulthood and is now his new roommate and best friend, while Ursula is trying to kind of grow up as normal as possible given this living situation. And there's lots of fun little twists and turns that it takes, but that's kind of a general synopsis.
Yeah. Sounds pretty fucked up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I really like this movie. I thought the atmosphere in it was fantastic. I thought they did a really good job. What the first film didn't do a good job of, what this film did do a good job of, was in the beginning, we don't really know what if there's anything going on other than just not-so-kid that thinks he can talk to this this doll. Because we do get some scenes where it's kind of implied that the dad is talking to Pin when nobody else is around.
Right.
And we do see, I mean, you alluded to it. It's early enough in the film that I think it's not a spoiler. We see one of the nurses have sex with Pin, which is fucked up in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, that raises a lot of questions that I don't really want to think about.
Yeah, but remind me to give you a little bit of a funny anecdote when we're done here. But I felt the film did a good job up until the point of that first car crash where you're like, well, wait, did Pin somehow cause that? Because the scenario is that Leon is caught talking to Pin, and the dad realizes, like, oh, like, this kid's more fucked up than I thought. He knew he had problems, but he's like, wow, more fucked up than I thought. And he's going to basically take Pin away so the kid won't have access to him anymore. And that's when all of a sudden this car accident happens. And I thought they did a really good job of kind of implying that, you know, maybe Pin caused the car accident. But I think it, by the end, it's pretty clear that it was just a car accident, that that's all that happened. But they kind of lead you on a little bit there, that maybe there's more to this Pin thing. Maybe the kid's not so crazy. And I thought that they walked that line quite well for the first half of the film.
Well, and the tension builds pretty well in that car scene too, because Pin's laying down. Like, he's a doll that doesn't stand. Like, he's constantly in a sitting position. So
yeah.
At first they like lay him down in the back seat, and then at one point they take a sharp turn, and so he's now like popped up and sitting there, and then the blanket that's over him starts to fall off. So it's a very cool transition to where now all of a sudden you look in the rearview mirror and there's just Pin back there. And
yeah,
the wife is really freaked out by the look of him, and it's just thinking, like, why are we taking this with us? Like, we're late. Like, this is just creepy. And I can picture a lot of, you know, I'm sure my wife would be the exact same way. Like, why the hell is this thing in our car now? Like, so
yeah,
it makes sense that she was that tense and just like, yeah, no. But it, yeah, it built it up really, really well. And you never completely know. And you're right, when they're kids, like, the way the dad's talking to Pin himself, and, you know, it's no different than I'm sure, like, all of us talk to ourselves or sing in the car, you know, whatever. Like, it's just,
yeah,
kind of pastime or think out loud. But and then we also transition too to where, as Leon gets a little bit older, he develops, or so we think, he develops that same kind of ventriloquism skill. And the first time he does it, everybody's kind of shocked, like, whoa, when did he learn how to do that? But
yeah,
as the audience, you're looking at it thinking, like, well, did he just, you know, practice ventriloquism until he could do this and make Pin talk, or is it really Pin? And you're exactly right. It's a very fine line.
Yeah, and I found, like, I really enjoyed that. And I think, I mean, really the moment, we're getting into minor spoilers here, but the moment that we finally realize that, okay, Pin is not, it isn't an inanimate object, and that Leon's the one doing everything, really comes with the aunt's death, which is, I mean, just a creepy, weird scene where basically Leon manages to manipulate her into having a heart attack, which is a little bit questionable as far as a way to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. But he startles her so much by having Pin in her bed, which apparently you're used to that. But, you know, like,
mannequins have skin, so.
All right. Well, so does Pin by the end of the movie. But, you know, there's that moment then when he kind of stands up behind Pin and you realize he's the one that's put Pin there and that Pin hasn't moved on his own. I think until then, I wasn't sure which way this was going to go.
And even with that scene, I wasn't sure if I liked that they revealed it, because I remember thinking when that happened, like, that could have been so much more tense if they would have just left it ambiguous and then you didn't know. But I ended up getting over it by the time the movie finished and you kind of saw where everything was building. It's like, oh, okay, well, that's fine then. But kind of thought, like, did you blow your load? Like, maybe you shouldn't have shown that it was actually him doing it, but turned out all right.
Yeah, and after that, I mean, the film really becomes about the relationship between the brother and the sister. She's basically just trying to figure out how to lead a normal life while her brother is at home. You know, he claims he's, what was it, a writer? So that's why he's home all day. He's not really leaving the house to get a traditional job. And he's just living in this giant house with this mannequin, and he's there alone with it all day while she goes to school and work. And it just gets weirder and weirder. I mean, as he starts to dress the thing up and bring it to the dinner table and all that kind of stuff. And I was just, like, genuinely creeped out by the idea of somebody putting this mannequin to the dinner table and setting it a plate and expecting it to eat.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, he was a poet, is what he...
Oh, is that what he was doing?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So he basically, like, dropped out of college and moved home after the parents' death, I guess?
But, somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so...
We see the kids three different ages throughout the movie, so it's... They're... I was gathering they're probably around, like, high school, college age, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think she gets her job at the library somewhere like halfway through the movie, and it's a job she's going to have while she finishes school. They talk about how when she's done school, but I assume that's high school, just because it's 1988 and female characters are still not portrayed as going to college. But I liked that. I thought that was all very interesting. I thought the relationship was very interesting, where they're both very protective of each other. I don't know if I thought that was strange, but I thought it was an interesting sort of almost like Children of the Corn type scenario, where it's like these two siblings are just like they feel like they don't have anyone else, so they're very protective of one another. And so Leon is protective of Ursula in maybe a negative way, and she's constantly not wanting to expose his insanity for fear that he'll be taken away from her.
Right.
I liked that relationship a lot.
Yeah, it was a couple of times it was giving me a little bit of an ookie feeling where I wasn't sure if it was going to cross over into a almost like incestual thing, because they were very close. I mean, not physically, but yeah, just the fact that they were clearly crazy and had no one else, like had to depend on each other. And when the aunt, you know, was no longer there anymore, like it tiptoed around that enough that I could have seen it going there, and it never did. Minor spoiler, but
minor spoiler: the brother and sister don't sleep together.
Yeah, I thought their relationship was good. I thought both characters were very believable, and the guy who's playing Leon, like, he did so in such a way that it really does unnerve you. And kind of like I said at the very beginning of the episode, like, this was a pair of movies that really, really did a good job of kind of delving into crazy. And with Tourist Trap, we saw that with that killer. Like, I mean, that was just insanity to the point of, like, funhouse crazy. And I think this was the kind of thing that, you know, I could almost see a like college psychology class watching this as kind of a film project, because I think it's a pretty good, you know, textbook piece on psychosis.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really thought it was, you know, I hate to say it's a textbook piece, because maybe it was it's very possible that it was a terrible view of psychosis from an actual scientific perspective, but I thought it was really good as far as being a TV version of it, a movie version of psychosis.
Yeah, so you weren't too big on Tourist Trap, but it sounds like you were a little more positive on this. Would you recommend this one to people?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, be prepared for a slow burn for a film that relies heavily on atmosphere and not so much on plot. But yeah, I would recommend this one to horror fans for sure.
Yeah, it's the atmosphere, and more so it's just kind of a character study, because you really only get the two characters the entire time. I mean, there's a half a dozen or so others that kind of show up from here, you know, for little bits and pieces. But I was kind of surprised that this goes through 3-4 distinct acts, and it's really just these two characters popping through the whole bit, and you're learning everything just from their perspective. But if you are in for that slow burn character study, I think, like, this is a pretty good one.
Yeah. Yeah. When you say it's just the two characters, if you look at the cast lists, it's like the third and fourth people are on the call sheets are the parents. And it's like, well, they die whatever, a third of the way into the movie. And we are really left, like you say, there are people who come and go, but we're left very much with just these two characters, and it's their relationship and their weird behavior that just governs the rest of the movie.
You kind of end up feeling bad for the boyfriend too, don't you? Like, even though he seemed like a little bit of a, you know, just douchey frat boy type, like, he, I don't know, it's like, I could picture that. Like, you meet a new girl, you getting excited for a new relationship, you meet her crazy as shit brother who, you know, living with a mannequin, like,
I do feel bad for that character, and they play him off, I think, intentionally douchey, in order to maintain a level of sympathy for our main characters. But at the end of the day, it's just like, what the hell are you supposed to do in that circumstance? You get invited home for dinner, there's four plates set, and three people in the house, and somebody goes, oh, let me get the mannequin.
Yeah.
That's who sits over there. All right.
And I love that opening scene when he first shows up to the house, because Ursula's already prepped him and told him all about Pin and all about her brother, and he's just so, I don't even know the right word, but like, he's playing along so well, and you can tell, like, he's just trying to be sweet, just trying to, like, you know, keep the conversation going. But at the same time, you can just, I mean, you can feel the tension on his face and in his delivery. Like, this guy's thinking, like, what the fuck am I getting into here?
What level of prepped could you possibly be that would cause you to go, oh, okay, there's just going to be a mannequin there that he talks to? No problem. That'll be fine. I don't see what could go wrong.
Wants to introduce me, expects me to talk to him. Like, yeah, this will be a fun night.
Yeah. You have to assume that in the back of his head he was thinking, oh, she's exaggerating the situation. It's just like an imaginary friend type scenario.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, no, he's got him in the clothes. This is weird. So,
or she was expecting, like, yeah, I've got, my brother that's home that's, five.
Yeah, I guess if it was a 5-year-old, you just wouldn't be that weirded out. It's like, well, since his parents died, we let him set a spot for his stuffed animal at the table.
Right.
All right, I can see that. That makes enough sense. No, the guy's 21 or something.
Just kidding.
So fucking weird.
Don't forget, Terry O'Quinn plays the dad.
Yeah. And he does a pretty good job, I think, of playing. He's a very strict, kind of cold father figure. But I think he does a good job of playing a father that you believe thinks he's doing what's in the best interest of his kid all the time.
Right.
Which is key, because when he's messing with their heads, pretending that a mannequin's talking to them, you need to understand that he's not trying to screw them. He's just trying to teach them life lessons that he thinks they need to know.
Well, and it's that same kind of parenting style when somebody is super detached or distant, very proper, like, these are not things that we talk about, but hey, if I use the anatomical dummy to tell you all about sex, that's okay. There's a couple other scenes throughout the movie that let's just say it's convenient that he's a doctor, and a couple of those he's just so clinical and so cold with matter of fact with what's going on, and it's just like, oh, I found some of those to be some of the most uncomfortable scenes in the film.
And the one, I don't even know if we should spoil it, but the one in particular where he's got the daughter in his office, that felt just so, because he was treating her so much like a patient, and it's like, that's your daughter. Like, you shouldn't be talking to her like she's not, you know, and it was very strange.
Yeah, so thumbs up for me. I enjoyed this. I was glad I finally got a chance to see it. I don't really know how to categorize it, really. Kind of, I guess it worked as a double bill in this case, but how do you recommend this to someone? Like,
if you like things that are fucked up, you'll like this. Is that acceptable? Or it's a very strange movie. I think the biggest thing is that it relies heavily on atmosphere. I think it's successful, but you can't go in expecting a lot to happen. Because a lot doesn't happen. I mean, at the end of the day, Pin is responsible for, I think, one murder in the entire film. That's not a lot for a horror film, but I think everything about it just sort of works. First time I saw this was like probably 1989 or 1990, late night on TV. Haven't seen it since then, but I'm just as creeped out now as I was then, 13 years old, watching it late night on TV, hoping there'd be nudity or whatever. And I, just as creeped out now as I was that night when I had a little trouble sleeping after seeing, half of this film on TV. So,
yeah, I could see this. I don't think this would be that disturbing for a young kid, because I think there's so much here that's like on a psychological level that you need to be able to kind of process and understand.
Yeah.
Maybe kind of like you were saying at that like 12, 13 year old age, like where you understand the crazy then.
It's just creepy and weird.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, that was our two mannequin themed movies, but we actually got a couple other mannequin related viewing in this week too that we can talk about. I'll take a few minutes to discuss those as well.
Yeah, sure, we're here, might as well do it.
All right, so the first one is actually a short from John Knotts, who you might recognize as the director of Jack Brooks' Monster Slayer, and he also did The Shrine, which we talked about several episodes ago on our horror episode. When right after we had done that, I was kind of chatting with him on Facebook a little bit, and he mentioned that, or because you and I had noticed that he had several shorts on his IMDb, so I got in touch with him to try to see if we could find some of those, maybe do a shorts episode. And he sent me a link to a few of them, and one of them I posted a link, I think, in Facebook a while back, but I'll definitely put one up in the show notes here, so if anybody hasn't got a chance to see this, they can. This is a short that he did in 2005 called Still Life. It's only about 9 minutes long, so it's a real quick little watch. take out in no time, and I don't even think you really need earbuds or anything, because I don't think there's any dialogue in it. There's some interesting noise, but
yeah,
pretty simple little thing, but mannequin themed. Don't want to spoil it because I think it's a pretty interesting story, but I would almost just recommend, if you haven't watched it yet, then maybe pause for 10 minutes, go click on the link and watch it, and then come back. I think that's fair.
Sure. People don't like it when you ask them to do that, but I mean, I think if we give people a spoiler warning now, it's only 10 minutes long. Take the time to watch it before you listen to the rest of this. That's not unreasonable.
Yeah. So, real, I know you had you saw this back when we were first talking about doing more John Knotts shorts, but had you watched this recently for the mannequin episode?
Yeah, conveniently you were late logging on tonight, so I saw this just before we started recording.
Oh, hey, see?
Because I had to kill time somehow.
It's like I planned it.
Yeah, not quite, but...
Yeah, so I remember really liking this the first time I watched it and rewatched it again, and to me, I think it still really holds up. What do you think about this?
No, I think it's fantastic. I mean,
yeah.
To give people an idea of what it is, it's Trevor Matthews, Jack Brooks, is driving a car. He's clearly running from something, we don't know what, and he shows up in this little town, which is apparently populated by mannequins, and it goes on from there. But I loved the way they would have the mannequins sort of, I call it like Mario Ghost style, where it's every time you turn around, they're a little closer, but mm-hmm. you never see them move. I really liked the way that worked in this film, the way he'd walk into a room and then there'd be these mannequins sitting at a table. He'd look out the window, and when he turned around, they'd all stood up to figure out, like the way people would if they were trying to figure out why you were in the room.
Right.
So I really liked the way that was happening.
Yeah, so at the very beginning, when he's driving, it doesn't really show you what he's doing, but you get the impression that he's taking some pills and drinking lots of coffee, so I was guessing it was just kind of sleep aids to kind of keep awake.
That's what I figured.
Most of us have been in that situation where we're driving and probably shouldn't because of how tired we are, but you know, your mind can definitely start playing tricks on you. But yeah, he shows up in this town then, and all the audio like still works. Like he can still hear people, he still hears traffic, he still hears everything like that, but just anywhere he looks, nothing's moving. And
yeah,
he kind of looks down the street, and I think one of the first things he gets just a glimpse of is there's a, you know, someone sitting on a like a park bench, and when he's turning around looking, he like has an accident, he thinks he hits something, like hears he hits something, but gets out, doesn't see anything, but finds a mannequin laying in the road. And yeah, it's that same kind of thing, like, you know, you do the double take, like when you look, nothing's moving, turn away, turn back and look, and now everything's moved closer. So it's like the kids playing the red light, green light game, kind of that similar thing, but all with inanimate mannequins, and kind of keeps going from there and takes a really dark twist by the end that I did not see coming, but it really kind of fucks with you.
yeah, it's really messed up. It's the kind of twist that goes completely unexplained, but that's fine because it's a 9-minute short. It's not like, you know, we invested 2 hours into a movie and then they don't explain the ending. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It is this weird Twilight Zone-y type thing that just happens, and you don't really need to have it explained why it happened. Very effective, good performance by Trevor Matthews. Really the only performance in it because everyone else is a mannequin. Really, really good, really high recommend if you're a fan of these sort of little YouTube shorts that we'll put up.
Yeah, and I got to give Trevor Matthews a lot of credit too, because this is now the third time I've seen him in something, and it's the second time that you've had to point out that, like, that's who that was, and both times I'm like, oh no shit, that was him, because when we were talking about The Shrine, and he was the crazy, you know, local who was, you know, shirtless yelling at the people to get off his land, like, and you're like, yeah, that was Jack Brooks. I'm like, well, no shit. Yeah, it was. And same thing here. Like, I've seen this short probably now 4 or 5 times, and it wasn't until just now that you were talking about that I was like, oh, yeah, that was him, wasn't it? So,
yeah, it turns out he can turn in quite a good performance when asked to. So
uh-huh.
It's kind of surprising that he hasn't popped up in things outside of the Brook Street world. maybe he has by now, and I just don't know about them.
Yeah, I don't know. But so, yeah, we've got a couple more John Knotts shorts in the back burner that we've seen, and we definitely do want to do a shorts episode at some point, but I like some of the other things that I've seen, so this was one that we just decided to pull out because, hey, mannequin themed, we had to go ahead and throw it in.
Sure.
But, yeah, I really like this one. If you're annoyed that we made you or told you to stop and watch it, well, get over it and go do it now.
Because don't challenge the listeners.
Do what I say.
All right, so you got one more thing you want to talk about?
Yeah, I don't know why this popped into my head as we were talking about the mannequin themes, but I've recently been on a Tales from the Crypt kick, and I've got most of the DVD season, so I was digging through and I was thinking to myself, like, there's got to be a Tales from the Crypt episode that's mannequin themed, and I dug and I dug and I dug, and turns out there's not. As I was standing there at my DVD shelf looking at all the Tales from the Crypt, flipping through them all, I looked right next to it and saw my complete collection of the Twilight Zone and thought, oh yeah, I know there's one of those. So kind of in a roundabout way, we ended up at a Twilight Zone episode that is also mannequin themed. So this was from the original run of Twilight Zone, season one. I believe it was episode 30 something. I don't know. It was definitely right toward the very end. Episode 34. There it is. First aired June 10th, 1960. The title is The After Hours. And so I had the DVDs, so I was able to pop this in and rewatch this one the other night in preparation for the show, and sent you the link. And I think you said you got a chance to watch it too, right?
Yeah, I did. So, hard to discuss a Twilight Zone episode.
A little bit.
I mean, it's a weird little thing. A bunch of strange things happen, and then we get an explanation as to why they're happening. And there you go.
I think you pretty much just described every episode that's ever aired.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what makes them difficult to talk about. I mean, this one here is basically a woman goes into a department store and nothing is normal. And she's being kind of directed to floors where there's nothing available and other things like that. I don't know. Can you explain the plot of this without going too spoilery? Because I only know how to explain what the spoiler twist is. I don't know how to explain the rest of the episode.
I'll do my best here. Basically, she walks into this department store. She's looking for a gift. And she's led to this. There's this whole line at the elevator. And this second elevator next to it opens up. And a guy that I swear was Bing Crosby's long-lost brother opens the door and is the elevator bellhop and says, you know, invites her in, says it's an express elevator, asks her what she's looking for. She says I think it's like a gold thimble is what she's looking for. And he says, oh yeah, it's special gifts, ninth floor. So this takes her up to the ninth floor, and as you see the elevator going up, like, clearly there is no ninth floor. So you already get your first little dun-dun-dun on Twilight Zone moment. And she gets up to the ninth floor, gets off the elevator. It's a completely deserted floor. Like, it's just storage, but there's nothing there other than fixtures and empty countertops. And a woman comes out and basically asks her if she's been helped and what she's looking for. She tells her she wants a gold thimble, and turns out she's like, oh yeah, there's one over there in the case. Looks over, and it's the only thing in the case. So something very magical, very supernatural going on, almost like a Needful Things type situation. Yeah. And yeah, it's really kind of hard to explain. And I think the one kind of problem that I had with this episode is that I'm a huge Twilight Zone fan, and I felt like this was one of the few episodes where all of the kind of like weird, mysterious stuff that's happening during the episode turns out has nothing to do with the twist whatsoever. And
yeah, that's true.
That's rare that Twilight Zone does this, especially this was one of the episodes written by Rod Serling, and usually those and the Richard Matheson ones are kind of like the top-notch ones. But so I was kind of surprised that this was a Rod Serling one, and still it just kind of was like, okay, like, I liked the twist and I liked all this stuff building up to it. I just felt like there was not really a whole lot that they had to do with one another. But yeah, I mean, the kind of non-spoilery version is that she ends up finding the thimble, goes downstairs, realizes he's damaged, tries to go back to the ninth floor, can't get up there because, of course, the floor doesn't exist. She explains it to the customer service department, and they're talking about, well, there is no ninth floor. Like, where did you get this? So they just think that she's hysterical, you know, treat her and, you know, give her a couch to lay on and whatever else. And she ends up there after hours. And, you know, then you kind of get your little twist reveal as she's in this department store by herself now after the store's closed. But it's a really kind of creepy atmosphere as it's going along. But then when things do get revealed, like I said, it's just kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can go ahead and spoil this. It is from 1960. I don't know if you're okay with it. I mean, the reveal is that she is one of the store mannequins, and that for whatever reason, the mannequins are able to, on a rotational basis, come to life for a month at a time, and they're supposed to come back at the end of their month and turn back into a mannequin so one of the other mannequins can go live amongst the real people for a month.
It's kind of like...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's kind of like what the Amish kids are allowed to go do before they...
Yeah, same idea, I think. But it's such a weird thing.
Exact same story.
Basically. I mean, and she's of course, trying not to come back, and they're pressuring her to come back. But, I mean, this... You're right when you say it doesn't really have anything to do with what's gone on in the rest of the story. Like, I don't know if we're supposed to think that the reason she was taken to that magical ninth floor was to turn herself back over, and she just didn't do it. But really, it is just that a bunch of weird shit happens, and then there's this whole story tagged on to the end. I like both. I don't really know how they're connected.
No, because, yeah, it doesn't explain why she has lost all memory of the fact that she's a mannequin, and it's at the very end they have to convince her and remind her that she's a mannequin. So they don't explain that part. They didn't explain why this other mannequin was playing along. Actually, two other mannequins, the elevator Bing Crosby guy and the girl who sells her the thimble, like, they're both mannequins too. So why are they playing along, pretending to be people working at this department store? And then at the same time, like, I don't know, like, why was she there shopping? Like, the whole thing just kind of fell apart.
Now, again, the thing about that is, because it's a 22-minute episode of The Twilight Zone, I wasn't bothered by the fact that things didn't really make sense.
No.
I was just enjoying it for what it is, which is, you know, a fun little exercise in watching a weird show that's never quite been duplicated. And I got a kick out of it. Enjoyed watching it, regardless of the fact that it didn't make sense.
Well, and I've seen this episode several times, and it wasn't until this time around that I kind of did think about it, because a lot of them, after you've watched them a lot, like, there's some that stick in your head and you remember the twist from the opening credits, but then there's others that, even though you've seen them several times, you still kind of say, wait, how does this resolve? And this was one of those. Like, I knew that this was a mannequin one, and I knew I had seen it a lot, but I'm like, why can't I remember what this is? And then as it finally clicks in, it's like, oh, that's because nothing leads you to this conclusion.
Yeah, no, it's just, oh yeah, this is a thing. This is happening. And whatever. It's fun to watch. I know that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're not going to talk about it on a podcast, you probably don't think about it that hard because it's a short little
that's
thing to see.
Very true. All right. Well, anything else? I feel like we decided we were going to have kind of a little short episode, and gone, what, about an hour now? So that's
good enough. That's what you're saying?
A little more than half of running time, but
that'll shut up the listeners that were complaining about missing this episode, right? Kidding, of course. Nobody complained about us missing an episode. Nobody cares. So
yeah, we did decide we're going to skip feedback for right now. Save all of the traditional kind of banter and other after theme stuff for next week, or for later this week, because we do have a regular episode coming out, which I noticed that you did plug next week's theme. I keep saying next week. You did plug this regular episode's theme in the special that you did last week without me, but we have a regular episode coming up this week, which was one that you had picked, and oh no, I'm already...
You had asked me to do this episode, and I said, well, I'll only do it if we name it Scott's Slasher Theme Birthday Party.
That's right. See, I'm already getting my weeks confused because I've already watched those movies, and so now I'm starting to like track down the next ones. So I'm just all thrown off and confused. How about this? You explain next week's episode. I'm just going to stop talking because I'm confusing even myself.
Okay, we're going to watch April Fool's Day and Happy Birthday to Me in honor of Scott's birthday and April Fool's Day, which this year fall on the same day, coincidentally. So,
actually, they fall on the same day every year.
What?
Mind blown.
I was being clever and you ruined it. All right, yeah. Let's get the hell out of here.
All right, so we look forward to that coming up in a couple of days. If all goes well, I'll have this little bonus episode up sometime midweek, and only a couple days later have a full episode. So can you, I don't even know if they can handle all of this. Like we might need to expand the site to deal with all the traffic we're going to be getting.
Yeah, no, nobody's going to care.